Hello, good morning. My name is Rachel Tromelin. I'm Assistant Professor of Physical Therapy at Louisiana State University Health Sciences Center in New Orleans. Today, we are recording a vestibular SIG podcast on the role of neuroplasticity. Specifically, how does neuroplasticity play a role in vestibular rehab? Today, we have two speakers to answer questions for us, Dr. Rick Klein-Daniel and Dr. Michael Schubert. I'll have them introduce give a brief introduction about themselves.
This is Rick Klein-Daniel. This is Rick Klein-Daniel. I am an assistant professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at Duke University. I received my PhD in behavioral neuroscience and did a postdoctoral fellowship with Dr. Susan Herdman, and continue to see patients and do research on vestibular disorders.
This is Michael Schubert. I'm a faculty member at the Department of Otolaryngology, head and neck surgery at Johns Hopkins, and I got my PhD in physical therapy from the University of Miami, and I came up to Johns Hopkins to study with Dr. Klein-Daniel to do a postdoctoral fellowship, and I currently see patients a couple of days a week, and I'm interested in vestibular ocular reflex adaptation in individuals that have pathology affecting their inner ear.
So our first question, what do you really think is happening with adaptation and habituation training?
Patients are getting better.
How so?
Yeah,
How do you think those changes are taking place?
Well, that's a really good question, and I don't think we have an answer to it at this point. We know that things like dynamic visual acuity improves post-training with gaze stability exercises. We know their balance improves. We know their symptoms tend to decrease. Actual mechanisms, it's not really clear at this point whether the system is really adapting, using compensatory strategies, or just learning how to deal with the symptoms better.
Yeah, I agree. And Rick published a paper with some pilot data, but beginning to address this, specifically looking at if you give a group of individuals these adaptation exercises, vestibular ocular reflex adaptation exercises, which, as you know, are gaze stability exercises, versus more habituation training, the idea that you're trying to provoke symptoms, those folks did equally well on an outcome measure of gaze stability known as the dynamic visual acuity. So it suggests that in part, at least having folks move leads to some benefit and leads to some improvement in both how they see clearly during head motion and just generally how they feel.
Okay, good. So what role do you feel neuroplasticity plays in this versus recovery on a cellular level in terms of recovery of vestibular reflexes?
Well, that's another tough question. Regarding actual recovery versus neuroplasticity, it's probably a little bit of both that's actually going on. We do know that the actual end organ can physically recover. That's been well established based on the more standard vestibular function tests that are done. So people, of course, do have natural recovery that occurs. We've tied in some of that natural recovery with some behavioral change, too. So, for example, we know that there is a saccade that is interjected during the head rotation in the direction of the deficient vestibular ocular reflex that has been shown to be modifiable relative to recovery of the VOR. So that is, we were fortunate enough, I guess, to record the vestibular ocular reflex both before, during, and after one particular person had recovery of the end organ. And there was less recruitment or less use of these compensatory saccades. Again, these saccades that sort of come in place when the vestibular system is deficient to assist gaze stability. So that there is this sort of dynamic interplay between recovery and neuroplasticity that occurs.
Yeah, I'd agree with Michael. But it's really difficult to with the recording techniques we have in humans to figure out how much recovery is actually occurring at a cellular level, because there's central compensations that go on to make it difficult to figure out what's actually going on in the periphery. But we see folks who initially have an abnormal caloric test and weakness on one side, and typically with like things like vestibular neuronitis. And then if you retest them and test the peripheral structures with a caloric test, they have recovered, and they no longer have a unilateral weakness. So there is some evidence for recovery in some individuals, or cellular recovery. But without that, it's hard to figure out the improvements that we see in terms of function and decreased symptoms, whether that's central compensation or actual peripheral recovery.
Okay. I know when I'm prescribing vestibular adaptation exercises, the guideline that I use is to expose my patients to 5 minutes of stimulus a day, and I feel like that's what it takes, or that's what I've been taught, what it takes to kind of get the VOR going again. So is that correct, or how much repetition is necessary to kind of induce those neuroplastic changes?
More is better, probably. I'm probably pretty much in the same boat as you, Rachel. I'd try to have folks do, let's say, if we're giving them gaze stability exercises, at least 2 minutes at a time, multiple times during the day. So I'm probably shooting for more than 5 minutes total during the day with specific exercises. Whether patients are completely compliant with that or not, we don't know. 2 minutes seems to work. It seems to be reasonable for patients to be able to do that without provoking too many symptoms. Would longer be better? Probably so. We just don't have the studies that have figured out appropriate dosages of these exercises yet. And I don't know, Michael, you might remember, it seems to me that, you know, if you take a normal human and put them in a rotary chair with a adaptation paradigm to try and change the gain, within about 5 minutes or so, they start to demonstrate some changes in gain. Do you remember?
I do. That's right. We've done it. We've done that, as you said, Rick, with both rotational chair. We've also done it with active head rotation, which, you know, mirrors a little bit better what we ask our patients to do. So we've had people in a completely dark room and basically exposed them to a target that moves a little bit in the direction opposite of the head rotation. So it's trying to drive the gain of the vestibular ocular reflex up. And it happens very quickly. And it's similar with the CAD adaptation that's been done. You know, you can put people in a unique context, so it's a bit isolated from that in that sense, that it's not necessarily a real world experience. But the system will change very quickly. The challenge, of course, is getting that retention, getting it to stay.
Yeah.
And I think that I would agree with both, you know, you, Rick, and Rachel, that, you know, multiple times a day is probably better. We haven't really studied dosing specifically, so it is hard to know. We have looked at, sort of indirectly, but we've looked at changes in dynamic visual acuity when exercises were done 3 times a day versus 5 times a day. Now, they were separate studies, but the results were the same. So somewhere around there, you know, you're exposing people for multiple minutes, probably somewhere 3, 5, maybe more times per day is necessary. And again, as you said, Rick, is there a plateau? Do people tap out? Is the response, you know, sort of flatline at some point? We don't know.
Yeah. And the other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, it's not just when they're doing the gaze stability exercises that they're getting the signals for adaptation. The more they move around during the day, the more head movement signals and gaze stability signals they'll be receiving. So I think one of the things with therapy is you simply get them moving again, and the system's going to figure out how best to compensate for the movements and the deficiencies in the vestibular system. So,
mm-hmm. And that actually leads perfectly into my next question. As a vestibular therapist, I see my role both as prescribing very specific ocular motor and balance exercises, and just more as kind of a coach and encourager, and just, you know, encouraging people to get up and move in any way that they can and return back to normal activities. So when our patients get better, how much do you think of them getting better is due to our prescribing specific exercises, and how much is just due to us encouraging them to resume all their normal activities and move around?
I don't know, to be honest with you. I think there was a neurologist at Hopkins who for years would joke around saying they don't need rehab, they just need to play ping pong, which in some respects could be true. It's just if they move around, they're trying to work on gaze stability. You know, if they're playing ping pong, they have to have head movements, body movements, gaze stability, gaze fixation, things like that. And getting somebody to move should lead to improvements in theory. I don't know that just having people be active, though, without doing specific exercises will be beneficial because they may get better, but they may not achieve their highest level of recovery. And I mean, as a case example, there was one person in the pilot study that Michael was talking about before who got better on all measures with the intervention. He had decreases in his dizziness handicap inventory, improved dynamic gait index, improved balance, et cetera, decreased in his motion sensitivity, yet his dynamic visual acuity did not improve. And he felt he was much better, and he was functioning at a higher level, but he wasn't as improved as we would have liked to have seen on measures of dynamic visual acuity.
Yeah, I think it's tough to know. You know, there's different strategies people adopt. So it may be that someone will report that they're feeling better just by starting to move around and general activity, but their head rotation is less, and you know, they're not moving as quickly, and or they're not turning their head much when they walk, for example. Susan Herdman did a couple of studies that were controlled as far as the types of exercises that folks were exposed to. And whether both groups were compliant or not. So there was a group that sort of did some eye-only exercises, so SACAD or smooth pursuit, and then there was a group that did these gaze stability exercises. And she showed in both individuals with unilateral and bilateral vestibular hypofunction that dynamic visual acuity was improved only in those folks that did the specific gaze stability exercise. That goes back to what Rick said, which is I think there is a role for specific exercise in here. There's no doubt that general activity also is going to be useful, but when it comes down to the unique contributions of the system, whatever system is you're trying to change, I think that the body changes and adapts uniquely to the stressors put through it. So I think people will get better when they're generally moving, but there is a role for more specific intervention.
And I also find, especially my patients who are a little bit more anxious and maybe restrict their daily activity more than they should, that I use the exercises to give them confidence to return back to activities. You know, for example, if I have a patient who's able to do a VOR times one when they're walking forwards, but yet they're afraid to walk out of their houses by themselves, you know, I can use that and say, look, you can, you know, in here you're able to walk and hold your balance and turn your head very quickly. You know, you should definitely be able to walk around in the community without turning your head at all, or, you know, with just normal head turn.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Is there any way, you know, that we can clinically evaluate if neuroplasticity has taken place?
I guess. How are you defining neuroplasticity?
Yeah.
That we're actually, you know, inducing changes in the brain, whether growing of, you know, new synapses or any of those processes.
Michael's waiting for you to chime in on this one.
Yeah, this is another tough one, Rachel. You know, I think it does depend on how you define it. You know, we know that there are changes that occur in animal models at the brainstem and at the cerebellum when you expose these animals to VOR gain change. So if you change the gain up or you change the gain down, things happen in the brain. And that's been recorded. We can't do that in people, obviously, but we can take pictures of the brain, and there are other systems that have been studied that show that the brain does change. You know, for example, some constraint-induced therapy sort of before and after. So clinically, though, I think that, yes, you can use some – there are ways to identify neuroplasticity. It's sort of a broad term. But, you know, clinically, I think if you look at dynamic visual acuity and that changes, that is evidence that there's change in the neural axis at some point. Similar with balance. Now, balance can improve for different reasons. There's multiple contributors for balance. But I don't think we need to take those clinical measures for granted. They're valuable, and that we are looking at change in neural processes. Now, what is that neural process for change? Is it the OR gain? Is it is it central nervous system processes? Is it the cerebellum, you know, releasing some inhibition on the central nuclei a little bit better? It's probably a combination of those things. It's hard for us to sort that out. But I think our clinical measures are measuring neuroplasticity. Exactly how that plasticity is occurring or what is the mechanism behind the change in those clinical measures, that is really tough. And probably where we're headed, I think, is doing some imaging studies. You know, it'd be neat to, for example, induce a change in gain of the VOR and then take pictures of certain regions in the brain, either with functional MRI or some other measure, maybe transcranial magnetic stim, and try to figure out what really is happening in humans when that occurs, and then matching that with the behavioral change that we saw, and that would give us a sense maybe of more of the mechanisms behind the clinical change.
Good.
Yeah. So again, you can use dynamic visual acuity as a measure of change. The thing that, as we said before, the thing that you don't know without recording the eye movements is whether that improvement is because the gain of the VOR is actually improving, or whether the person is making these compensatory saccades during the head movement, or a combination of the two. You could argue that even if the gain of the VOR is not improving, but the person is adopting compensatory strategies, that too is a measure of neuroplasticity, or is a form of neuroplasticity from a systems level to allow you to maintain or to improve your gaze stability during head movement. So, again, you're a little – I agree with Michael. I wouldn't discount the clinical measures that we use. They can't answer all the questions as to what's actually going on, though.
And definitely, you know, it's important for all therapists is, you know, our patients are improving whether they're actually making changes or they're making these compensatory saccade movements, as long as they're able to be functional and go back to their everyday activities. That, of course, is our first and foremost goal.
Right.
In terms of the speed of the VOR exercises, I usually train my patients up to about 120 hertz. That's the goal for frequency of head movements during VOR. Is there any benefit to varying the speed, or do I need to be training at a faster speed?
Well, 120 hertz is really
fast.
Probably meant maybe a degree.
I'm sorry, 2 hertz, 120 beats per second.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the one thing to keep in mind is that frequency of normal head movements when you're doing things like walking and running are above 2 cycles per second. So we typically test at 2 cycles per second, but that's mainly because you want to make sure that they're not able to use smooth pursuit to maintain gaze stability when you're doing like dynamic visual acuity testing. So I don't track how fast they're moving their head when they're doing the exercise. I just want them to continually try to move faster and faster, still maintaining the visual target, or, you know, a clear view of the visual target, so they're not getting visual blurring or jumping or oscillopsia. And then I just kind of go judge based on how they do with the DVA test and how they're doing with symptoms as to whether they need to continue or move faster with their head movements. So I haven't been in the practice of, you know, counting how many cycles they, or how many repetitions they make within a minute or 2 minute time frame.
I agree. I think this is where physical therapists, where we're really good at, you know, we're good at creating challenging exercises, you know, to achieve these different results. So I'm similar. I'll teach folks to do the gaze stability exercises and encourage them that that they try to move their head, you know, faster depending on the clarity of the target, and that's gonna progress at some rate. And I'm not necessarily concerned about how fast they can move it, but then I change it into more functional activity. Let's do it now while you're doing this activity. There's other parts of gaze stability, such as the gaze shifting exercise with two targets, where that's more of a rapid head impulsive rotation. But I think you'll end up, by incorporating function as part of the rehab, that there is sort of this broader spectrum of head motion. I mean, Rick has done some really neat studies showing that the VOR actually does adapt uniquely to the stimulus that you impart it when you're training. That's a little bit harder behaviorally in people and functionally to try to parse out, but there is this specificity within the system. I'm not sure how you do that clinically other than just encourage folks to continue to move their head and see targets clearly and then broaden that application.
At least it leads very well into the next question. When I typically give the OR exercises, I have patients do it in a neutral neck flexion position, so with their head straight. Will that improve their VOR abilities, for example, with their head extended or with their head flexed?
It should. In the matter of whether the neck is neutral, extended, or flexed, most of it, if you're working on VOR exercises that are horizontal head rotation, you're still going to get basically the same rotation, the same stimulus to the canals, regardless of the head position on the body or in space. Now, you will change the otolith input, obviously, or the kind of the tonic otolith input when you have the head tilted one direction or another. So, as Michael was saying, you can have these specificity of training effects you can mess around with the super system or the central nervous system as much as you want. We've done these things typically with VOR training as well as SCAD training, where you adapt in one condition in one direction, you adapt the other. So gain up condition, well, let's say with your head tilted back, gain down condition with your head tilted down, or even just looking down. And the system will learn to use those otolith signals in that case to pull out the right gain for the VOR. But I think in a patient, if you adapt the gain with a neck in neutral, it should have carryover with to gain changes or to changes to measures of gain with the neck extended and flexed. I don't think you'll see that much difference between the two unless you set it up experimentally to do that.
Yeah, and I think also this goes back to an earlier point that I think Rick made, which was that our patients are getting retinal slip exposure throughout their day when they're not doing the exercises we ask them to. If they are moving their head, which they will be if they're walking. So, you know, that there will be, again, this error signal that drives the change they should be getting in addition to the exercises that have been prescribed, and that should help them as well.
And our last question for the day, and I feel like this is, could be a complicated question. It could probably take a whole day to answer, but to do your best to answer. Why do you think that some people get better with the same vestibular diagnosis and the same symptoms while others do not?
it's so hard for me to learn a certain pattern on the drum kit when others can learn it easier. And you're right, this is tough. Another thing is, you know, I see folks that have, for example, positional vertigo. I've seen a handful of folks who have classic posterior canal canalithiasis on one side. They feel nothing. And their chief complaint has been sometimes just imbalance. Sometimes it's a little bit of lightheaded spaciness, but there's no spinning sensation. And frankly, when they're in the position, they sometimes will say, yeah, I feel a little bit of something. It's not that bad, though. And other times, of course, and I imagine you all have had this experience as well, that there's a little bit of nystagmus and there's this, you know, very robust response. I think, you know, it's partially related to the brain and how the brain, you know, how we have different compensatory strategies that are used, how we perceive the world uniquely, that is responsible for this broad sort of spectrum that we see in folks.
Yeah, it's a really difficult question to answer. And I know Susan Herdman's doing a lot of work in this area, or continues to do work in this area. And a recent paper she had published showed that, you know, people will get better, but not universally so across all different measures. So some people will get better on psychological measures or you know, measures of symptoms and not necessarily show improvements in physical performance or vice versa. And some people show no improvements and some people show improvements across the board. Obviously, if there are, or maybe not obviously, but I think if there are other things that are going on with the individual, if there are other central nervous system issues going on, if they have other medical issues, I think that can affect the recovery process. I think stress plays a huge role in how well people compensate, and that stress can be either physical or emotional stress. But, yeah, we see folks, and I'm sure you've seen them as well, who by all appearances are okay except for the fact that they have a vestibular neuronitis or bilateral vestibular loss or whatever, and we expect them to get better and they don't, and that's the big question as to why not, and is there something else going on that we're missing?
And something else too that's been shown is that, you know, a patient's perception of the level of disability that they have has been shown to contribute to how disabling their symptoms actually are. So those folks that perceive that they're generally healthy tend to do better than those on certain measures, even though they may have more evidence of damage. So they might have a vestibular system that has a lower gain on some sort of outcome measure, but their perception of health is higher, and so they're not bothered by as much oscillopsy, for example, as someone who would have a better gain, but their perception of their health is not as high, and so they are more disabled by the symptom. And so, again, whether it's the adrenal stress hormones, whether it's, you know, just some personality, physical stress, emotional stress, as Rick mentioned, those all are probably very important in compensation and getting better.
No, go ahead, Rick.
So two other things. One is that although I don't think, you know, the length of time the person's had the unilateral vestibular loss is a huge issue, there's a paper published by Neil Shepard, Steve Tellian, and others a number of years ago, and they looked at people with chronic vestibular disorders, and they found that people who had been, I think, like off work for, or had to change their jobs for 6 months or more, were less likely to get better or to show improvements with therapy than folks who had not been off work for that long or had to, you know, that disabled for that long. And the other thing we've seen down here, and this has not been, to my knowledge, they haven't written it up anywhere, but we've seen a number of folks with Ramsey-Hunt syndrome, so they're getting a unilateral vestibular loss as a result of that, and everything's stable. You know, they're not having any fluctuating symptoms or anything like that, but they just don't compensate. And they've actually gone in and done spinal taps on these individuals and found some markers of central abnormality. So that some of these things that we think are, you know, peripheral vestibular nerve damage may actually have more central nervous system effects than we recognize, and that could be a compounding factor to the recovery process.
Yeah, and we all know that these disorders can be, you know, very difficult from a differential diagnosis standpoint.
Right.
So maybe a patient, you know, we think who has vestibular neuritis, you know, has Ramsey-Hunt or another disorder, making it more difficult to recover.
Yeah.
If
there's any fluctuation in their symptoms, not related to movements or position changes, any sporadic or spontaneous fluctuations, so the system's really not that, is not as stable as we think it is, that is going to affect their ability to compensate as well.
And I definitely agree with both you gentlemen in terms of that I think the psychological factor definitely plays a big role in recovery from these symptoms. And I think vestibular therapists do a really good job recognizing this and treating this and trying to, you know, mitigate the psychological factors as much as possible. And I certainly think a lot of other therapists could learn from our techniques in that realm in terms of treating patients with other disorders that cause psychological stress.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think you gentlemen did a great job answering some very, very difficult questions, and I think there's a lot of good information that therapists can take into play and use to help treat their patients a little bit better. So both Rick and Michael, I thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, Rachel.
Okay, thank you, and take care.
All right, bye-bye.